I'm Alan Lytle, 91.3 WUKY News. The Urban County Council takes an important vote tonight that could result in the relocation of two Confederate statues adjacent to Cheapside Park. My guest today is a Civil War historian who's written an op-ed for the Lexington Herald Leader about that decision. Ann E. Marshall is a Lexington native who now teaches history at Mississippi State University, and she's the author of Creating a Confederate Kentucky, Civil War Memory in a Border State. And 2 years ago, you advocated that the statues of John C. Breckinridge and John Hunt Morgan remain there, with perhaps some counter symbols and verbiage added to provide more context. But now you say those statues should be moved. So what's changed?
Even after the events in Charleston underscored the connection between Confederate symbolism and racist thinking, I believed in what historians and others are now calling a contextualist point of view, which means that while we understand that monuments were created and erected not just to honor fallen heroes, but rather to control politics and policy in the present, to send a message that whites were trying, at a time when whites were trying very hard to continue to keep African Americans from attaining the rights that they were fighting for in the late 1800s and early 1900s. We believe that we should keep these monuments, and instead of a sort of erasing history, which is how some people put it, or whitewashing history, we believe that you should add to that history and to contextualize it and to put more markers up, to be more inclusive, to tell a broader story. In this case, it would mean talking about the Cheapside slave market and connecting not only the fact that this was a slave market, but that the Confederacy was fought to protect that right to sell slaves and to hold slaves and to keep slaves. Since then, I've really changed my mind on this. Thankfully, historians, unlike political figures, are allowed to change their minds. And the reason that I did this, well, there were several, but the foremost one was watching what happened in Louisville. To my mind, the Confederate monument at the edge of University of Louisville's campus was a good example of contextualization. Beginning in the early 2000s and culminating in 2012 with the opening of Freedom Park, activists and scholars in Louisville decided to place a counter monument, if you will, to the African American experience in Louisville, and that was Freedom Park. It contains multiple panels that tell a full story of Louisville's Civil War experience, the story of slavery in Louisville, and it was a great project. I think it turned out really nicely. But as we saw, it just didn't work. You know, this was a project that was supposed to counter the power that kind of emanated from this giant Confederate monument across the street. But students and professors and general citizens at Louisville did not feel like that was enough. And so that gave me a lot of pause to think about why that was. And really, if you look at it, what I came around to is that in a time in which these obstacles and this oppression that people were trying to overcome in the past, you see that it's not just the past, it's the present, and that these are still issues that they're dealing with today. So when the oppression is today and when the obstacles are still here today, no amount of recontextualizing history is going to remove the power from these monuments. And so I feel like that's why they need to be moved.
And possibly to some other public space, maybe where there is more space to try to tell and contextualize this history. What we've saw in Durham, people took it upon themselves to tear down a monument on their own. Obviously, you're not advocating for that to happen.
No. And I believe, you know, were people to do that with the monuments in Lexington, that constitutes a Class D felony. So, no, I wouldn't advocate doing that. I understand the cathartic symbolism involved in that, but I don't think that's what what you should do. Yeah, and I do think it's important to note, too, that the people who take down these monuments should be responsible for interpreting them afterwards. And that didn't happen in Louisville. I mean, the University of Louisville sort of caved to the pressure of taking down these monuments and then proceeded to give them a new home and welcome home in Brandenburg, where rather than being contextualized, it's sort of put up in its original and, you know, with its original intent, just in a different location. So I think that Mayor Gray and what other, council members and other people who have input in Lexington are trying to do and thinking responsibly about what to do with these monuments is important. Context is really important, and being able to explain these monuments in their full history rather than just as objects of reverence, as objects of monumentation, is really important.
And I'll go back to this Brandenburg installation. It was met with a celebration and cheers and a returning hero just further up the river. So what you have there is also kind of a disconnect in terms of how we look and still view the Confederate cause.
Right, exactly. And I think that speaks, Brandenburg is has a very different demographic in terms of, its population and the people who live there. It's perhaps not surprising that it was welcomed there and seen very differently than it was in a city like Louisville.
A little bit more about Cheapside, because people are not, I don't think they're fully aware that Cheapside was a slave market and one of the larger ones certainly in Kentucky and all of the South. What research have you done on Cheapside, if any? I might be putting you on the spot here, but maybe give us an idea of just how large this market was and why that plays into this statue controversy.
Right. Well, I think, and I'm not an expert on Cheapside in particular, but Lexington was a booming slave market from the 1830s, really till the Civil War. And that was because of the major exodus, the sort of demographic shift that happened in our country due to the growth of the Cotton Kingdom further south in areas like Mississippi and Louisiana and Alabama and Texas. And so during the antebellum era, hundreds of thousands of slaves were sold from areas like Virginia and Kentucky, so these upper south locations where, because of the kind of agriculture that was prevalent with tobacco and hemp and corn and livestock in the upper south, there just wasn't the need for quite as many slaves, as much slave labor in the upper south. Well, because this growth in the cotton economy drove up the prices for slaves, a lot of upper south slave owners realized that they could sell their slaves at a profit. And I think there is this misconception that slavery in Kentucky was more benign than it was in other more southern locations. It may have been less arduous in terms of the actual physical labor, but because so many Kentucky slaves were sold to the lower south during this 30-year or so period, really Kentucky was in at the heart of perhaps the worst aspect of slavery, which were slave sales. Families were ripped apart in Cheapside. And so that's a really, I think, important thing to keep in mind. And Lexington was a prime slave market. This was sort of a gathering location for slaves that came from further from the east. It was, and then they would be sent to Louisville and put on a boat and, taken down the Ohio to the Mississippi and down to New Orleans and Natchez and other locations where they would be sold. And so really, Cheapside is really symbolic in that it's the sort of the start, of the horror for many thousands of slaves. So it wasn't just Kentucky slaves who were sold there, and it wasn't just Kentucky slaves sold to other Kentucky buyers. This was sort of the start of this you know, horrific journey into the unknown, for many, many human beings.
And Mayor Gray has made a point that these statues kind of add insult to injury because they were placed alongside what the place called Cheapside.
Yes, I think that's true today. I think the people who placed them there probably didn't think twice about it because it was all sort of, you know, it was all sort of, you know, they didn't think that what they had done in the past was so terrible. Very few people would have argued for the return of slavery, but they sort of saw it as a sin that was past. And they didn't see the connection between the sins of the past and the current day. At that time, you know, it would have been the late 1800s, early 1900s, the current day forms of racial control that they were engaged in. These very same people who wanted to put up these monuments were also very much engaged in creating and enforcing Jim Crow laws during this very same period that these monuments were going up. This was the heyday of lynching. I mean, Kentucky had thousands of lynchings, and so during this period. So, you know, this is all of sort of one piece.
And it represents revisionism in a way. I mean, because as we mentioned, Kentucky never seceded from the Union. Yes, it was a slave-holding state, but it was a border state, and it technically remained neutral during the Civil War. Correct?
Right, but I think that very revisionism speaks to the power of these monuments, both then and now. The fact that Kentuckians wanted to honor John C. Breckinridge, a man for whom they didn't vote. He was a Southern Democratic candidate in 1860, and instead most white Kentuckians gave their votes to John Bell instead, who was the Constitutional Unionist candidate, because they wanted to keep the Union together. And John Hunt Morgan, who really ruined thousands of dollars in property, whether it be barns and crops or horses. He stole, you know, hundreds of horses from Kentuckians, and so then they come in and spend all this money afterwards. And so this is definitely an object of criticism from people during the time in which these monuments were built. In fact, when the Kentucky legislature decided to give money to the John C. Breckinridge Project. And that's another thing. The Kentucky legislature gave thousands of dollars to both the John C. Breckinridge Monument Project and to the John Hunt Morgan Project. But when they decided to do this in 1875, after Breckinridge's death, a Cincinnati newspaper noted the sort of irony of this, you know, giving money to a man who was, you know, a traitor and for whom Kentuckians weren't really supportive, all that supportive of, you know, during the war. And they said, what shall be the moral to young Kentuckians? What shall be the moral to young Kentuckians? And, you know, I think we can ask the same question today. We've come to a point in our history where we need to ask, what is the moral of these statues? And, you know, I think that's another reason why we just need to move them.
Moving is one thing. Where, I don't want to put you on the spot and say, where do you think they should go? But where would a proper place for them be?
That's a great question. I think ideally probably a museum or a public building where they could be, rather than sort of representing public power, they could be a part of an exhibit that is, you know, provides a broader view of history. It's, you know, we have to be careful because simply moving them from one place to another doesn't necessarily, you know, denude them of power, as we saw with the move of the Louisville statue to Brandenburg. But, you know, I know that there are logistical challenges to doing this. So, you know, I know that's going to be an issue in Lexington.
I want you to look outside your window, and you're teaching in Mississippi. What kind of potential conflicts are there in terms of Confederate monuments? Are you seeing any kind of sentiment that's changing in that state?
Well, yes. Actually, that's an interesting question because in the aftermath of Charleston, our state flag became a huge issue. We're of course, the only state in the country now that still has a Confederate flag as part of the state flag, and this upsets a lot of people, and this is something that's going on. You know, some people have filed a lawsuit in Jackson to try to get the state flag changed because there was a referendum in the 1990s to try and get that changed. And so on our campus, we did have protests a couple of years ago to basically have the state flag removed, not flown, from any place on campus, basically saying if we're not, if the state flag is not going to represent us, and if we're not able to change the state flag, then we just don't want the state flag on campus. And so that's what finally happened. It took quite a bit of protest, but now most of the universities around Mississippi have taken the state flag down off of campus. And so I think you see a real divide here because you see university communities and students, younger students, who are at odds with the rest of the state on this issue. And so we're having to make accommodations like this when you can't actually change a symbol.
What about monuments themselves?
Yes. They are controversial in Mississippi, though I would say not to the point of some of these other places. But the interesting thing is in my own town of Starkville here, the United Daughters of the Confederacy actually put up a monument to the Confederacy during the flag referendum issue. It's a very new monument compared to others. And I think that in itself, again, underscores the context in which these monuments went up. It's not just the monuments that appeared in the 1800s and early 1900s that were connected to this power in the present, the power to represent in the present. It's the newer monuments sort of continue along that same theme.
Very fascinating. Always wonderful to talk to you. Anne E. Marshall, author of Creating a Confederate Kentucky Civil War Memory in a Border State, born and raised Lexingtonian, obviously watching from afar what's taking place here in our town and what it might mean going forward. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.